to New Mediator. I'm Dave Lamorte. Today's episode is an interview with artist Michael X. Rose. Michael is a Hudson Valley artist based out of New Paltz in upstate New York. He's someone whose work is definitely esoteric, on the occult end of things, not in an ironic way, as you'll hear in the interview, but he's also a bit of a throwback technique-wise as well. I like to look at his paintings, and they, although at first brush they might seem like folk art, but in my mind I kind of see them more as twisted historical paintings. Again, you know, this is an audio podcast about visual art, so this is more going to be talking about Michael's ideas. However, this is going to be an enhanced podcast, so if you want to check out some of his work, look at your probably Apple device, because I'm assuming that's the only one these enhanced podcasts will work on. And I'll also put an MP3 version out. So if you can't get the enhanced version for some reason, go over to Michael's website, and there will be a link over at newmediator.org. You can go straight over to michaelxrose.com. Of course, if you want to support New Mediator and our artist community, you can search for stuff on our Amazon widget at newmediator.org, and a couple shavings off the pennies you spend on Amazon will go to us with no additional charge. And of course, as always, go over to iTunes or whatever, wherever you find the podcast. You can rate and review us, and those reviews will help us find new listeners and are a huge help. So let's jump into the interview with Michael right now. I know you're from, you live in New Paltz now, am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm a, go ahead, sorry.
What area of, to me, anything above Westchester is, upstate New York, so I don't really know New York that well.
I hear you, I agree. Yeah, I started, I could tell you, I went to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, and I minored in art ed as a senior, just for a fallback thing. So I was teaching art in New York City after... I started doing that when I was 30. I got a master's. You know, they make you get a master's degree now in New York State.
Oh, really?
If you want to be a teacher. So I was working as I bumped into this job being a plasterer, and it was great. I was working off the books, getting cash for, doing, moldings, really kind of advanced stuff. And I took a big, big pay cut to go into teaching, but it was so crazy teaching, in the ghetto in New York City. That I did it for 2 years. That I told my wife I was either going to do something else, change careers, or I started sending out resumes, and I didn't even know where Orange County was. I work in Orange County, and I was like, is that in California? So I'm with you on that. This is what I can tell people, because now I know upstate New York pretty well. I'm about halfway to Albany. I'm right between Albany and New York City. And I'm right at the beginning of the Catskill Mountains. If you ever come to New Paltz, there's a SUNY there, which makes it great. So there's a good library, and some bands come through, rock bands that you can check out. And it's right where the Catskills start. So I grew up kind of on Long Island as a young kid, and I, loved the beaches. I always used to, with my buddies, we would get, a bottle of vodka or tequila and go to Jones Beach on the bus every day. And I didn't want to move away from the beach, but I found some really cool swimming holes up here and stuff like that, kind of like those old Mountain Dew commercials where you can swing on a tire and jump in a river and stuff.
It's funny that you said you used to be a teacher, because, I'm looking at, and I'll probably put some images of your work, the ones from your slideshow on the website, the stuff that's, very public, in the feed, the actual audio, so people while they're listening can look at it. And it's not the kind of stuff I would talk about with my students, because I teach little kids now. So I'm actually an art teacher by day. So it's
I think I remember that now. I remember talking about that. Yeah,
and it's just not that these are they're historical paintings, but they're definitely on the more violent end of history, which I don't know. I guess maybe that's all of history.
No, well, I totally agree with you, and some people at work who I'm good friends with that I tell, about my website and stuff are like, dude, they don't get it. But they're like Orange County natives, who've never even been to New York City, kind of. And believe it or not, I work with, I don't want to say too much about my work, but I work with emotionally disturbed kids.
Okay.
So, I really do get a lot of my ideas from them and working with them. And, I always drew as a kid, and I've got kids now, teenagers and stuff. And I think as a kid you forget, like, how your stuff freaks out adults. I mean, you draw skulls. Remember, in high school, man, I just drew skulls all the time, just kind of as a fallback, you know, to kill time in math class. You know, skulls, swords, knives, guns, right?
Yeah, I think that's like that'd be like a normal thing. Whereas like now, and I was like a pretty well-adjusted kid. I wouldn't say I was angry. I was definitely like on the nerdier end. And I remember I used to draw all kinds of like violent stuff, just because like television back when I was a kid was so much more violent. Like I guess like kids' television was so much more violent than it is now.
Yeah, now it's sex. Well, yeah, and I just loved comic books. Like things I was reading, like, you know, Weird Tales, and there were some great war ones like Weird War and like Sergeant Rock, and I've always been a big reader, and I always have, like, you know, I read all H.G. Wells, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, the stuff you read as a kid, and it's all violent and filled with ghosts and zombies and vampires and stuff, you know, and like people forget, like, Grimm's Fairy Tales, which was like the staple of like Western culture. There's a witch who's going to cook Hansel and Gretel and eat them and stuff. I mean, you know, kids know that it's, like, not real, you know. But adults, I think, forget that, you know.
I think it's this impulse. And I have the impulse. Like, I'm a parent and a teacher. And, like, I deal with kids who have emotional problems, too. Not my whole day, but definitely part of my day. And it's just, like, you constantly want to protect them. But in some ways, it's, like, you know, if they're drawing it on the piece of paper, you can at least have a conversation about it. If they're just thinking about it or trying to do it, it's a little bit more difficult to deal with.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in that. I'm a big believer in at least letting the kid make the art, especially in school, and then talking about it. I mean, I work in classrooms. I go into classrooms, so I don't have, like, an art room. And really often, like, aides and stuff say, you can't draw a gun, you can't draw a sword. And they'll like, step in and tell a kid to stop doing what they're doing. I'm like, whoa. You know, because to me that's just inappropriate. Because if a kid really is disturbed, say, and suicidal and blah, 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 I'm a big believer in venting and blowing it off and expressing yourself instead of saying, like, you can't. You know, your thoughts are illegitimate. To me, that's what will drive a kid crazy. But, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely guilty of doing what the aides do. Because, I mean, you know, I'm dealing with, like, general ed kids. Because I go into the classroom, too. And because, like, where I teach in the – I don't want to call it the ghetto. It's definitely, like, it's got its, you know, more well-off people. And it's definitely lower socioeconomic. We have a lot of, like, Title IX kids, too. And and I'm always worried that they're going to get caught up in something bigger than them if they end up doing something violent. So what I'll end up doing, usually I try and, like, steer them away from it, or I'll have them talk about it. Because if I talk for a kid for 5 minutes and he still determines he's going to draw that gun in his picture, then at least I've done the diligence where I've discussed it with them, and I can, like, make documentation saying, like, I was confident that this kid was not being violent and this was something either he really wanted to get out or something he was exposed to. And if it's a problem, someone who actually knows how to counsel him should talk to him, not just, you know, me.
Well, I like to give them, like, legitimate arenas for that, even. Like, so I do for myself, even. Like, I always tell the counselors and the psychiatrists, because I think people forget this. Little boys, especially, I mean, you know, 90% of the kids I teach are boys. They believe in good and evil. And, I mean, I always say, look, a gun killed Hitler. Cops carry guns. I teach a lot of kids whose parents are in the National Guard, man.
Right.
I think it's just wrong to say that, like, guns are bad. So I present a topic like pirates. Let's do some work about pirates, you know, and give them, like, an honest venue. Or, like, you know, we looked at Renaissance art, and we looked at St. George and the Dragon. You know, here's a knight in armor killing a dragon. And it's pretty gory. It was by Raphael, you know. And you just got to find, I think, like, healthy ways to show, you know, to explore the violence. And I guess that's what I'm trying to do in my work, I think. Like, I know sometimes I do some stuff that's a little more tongue-in-cheek or, you know, I'm trying to push the envelope. But, like, I definitely – one thing I've been doing in my art lately anyway is trying not to I think a flaw when I look around at a lot of art is that it's tongue-in-cheek or sarcastic or ironic, you know? So I'm trying to do some things that I really are, like, sincere, you know? and like honest, because everybody nowadays is so like self-aware, you know.
Yes.
So what if you could do something like, and you really meant it, like it was an honest, it was honestly what you thought, without having to be like, you know, cool or, you know, hip, you know.
And that's definitely something that, like, it comes through, I think, in a lot of your work. Certainly in the zine catalog I bought from you at the Fountain Fair was, it seemed like it was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but, like, the paintings were definitely taken seriously. It wasn't so much, like, a play on, like, to me, like, I look at your figures, like, I have the slideshow running while we're talking, too, because I think it kind of helps me think about your work. But, like,
oh, sure. Cool.
A lot of your paintings are very, very detailed, even if, like, the figures are sometimes slightly simplified, I guess maybe because of the size of the canvases and stuff, but it really feels like early Christian artwork to me.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's a big inspiration to me, that era of art. But, yeah, one thing, when I'm making a piece, and I read this about Poussin, said this about his work, you know, first, one of my goals is just that, just as a philosophical point to kick off against, is to make a painting that you could look at for 10 years, you know, and still find something new. So a lot of people look at my work and they think it's, like, naive or, like, folk art, like it has a lot of detail. And that's – maybe that just means I'm not a good painter, I've taken to saying to people. But I'm trying to put so much freaking stuff in there that you could look at it for 10 years. And I'm kind of kicking off of that Warhol idea that, like, you know – art is like a magazine ad, like you can look at it for 3 seconds and move on, you know. And I don't want people to misunderstand me. I really love Warhol, and I think his place in art history is awesome. But, like, you know, for me, like, you know, what do we do now? Like, my goal is, like, and not just to add, like, I'm not saying, like, useless detail either, but, like, I have things in my paintings, like in the book you're talking about, where I have cuneiform writing and stuff that actually says stuff that you could read, decipher. Like, I found out cuneiform is actually phonetic, like the way hieroglyphics are.
Oh, really?
So once I learned the alphabet, yeah, it's not symbols like Chinese, which when I was growing up, I thought it was kind of like character-based.
Right.
It's not. So I got a cuneiform alphabet. And again, it's weird to mention this, but yeah, I was teaching like Near Eastern art to my high school kids. And I got so into, like, we rolled out some clay and we took a read and we were writing like poetry in cuneiform, you know, just whatever they wanted to write, just writing things in clay by pressing it and stuff like that. And then, made me do more research, like as an adult, like about Near Eastern gods and demons and stuff like that. And
well, I think so, sometimes when you have someone like who the work's kind of like overwrought or like so photorealistic, it sometimes takes away from the actual intended message of the painting. Like, I feel like, sure, some of your characters are simplified, but I wouldn't say they're folk art, because, like, I'm looking at, like, the
cool,
wolf in the
Path. That would bother me. Like,
yeah.
To me, since you brought it up, I want to throw this. To me, realism, like, as an end of itself is a dead end, man. I mean, of course, there's cameras and stuff, but even, like, if there weren't cameras, like, being able to paint is not just for technical, like, display. I mean, it's a means to an end, you know, for me. And I think, like, to me, somebody who paints, like, photorealistically, that's as bad on say, the conservative side, if you want to put it in that regard.
Right.
As somebody who, you know, is doing totally conceptual stuff that's, like, anti-visual. To me, those are, like, two extremes, you know, where people forgot, like, what they're really supposed to be doing.
But I don't even think I mean, maybe at a moments class, I would maybe see folk art, but I think there's too many colors, too many textures, too much, like, rendering, and, like, I don't know, all of your characters feel three-dimensional in a way, like, whereas folk art, it's very, like, you know, trying to just represent things.
Sure, well, thanks, because a lot of people, like, you know, I met my wife in art school, and she's always like, well, I can draw. She says, I'm naturally good at drawing. Everything you know how to do is through hard work and sweat, you know. So,
what a wife thing to say.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's good. It keeps my ego in check, you know.
Yeah, because like like there's a ton of detail in a lot of these, and sometimes you know, because you look at like the Christians fed to the leopard. I'm looking mostly at this stuff. I actually packed away the zine because we're in the middle of a move, so I actually couldn't pull it up right before the interview because we were out. But like just some of the stuff I'm looking at now, like some of the stuff that's more simple. I mean, it has a lot to do with like you know the technique of the painting. Like its tempera stuff is going to be a little bit more simplistic that something's in oil, but
yeah.
But I think like I think people's understanding of folk art is very, you know, limited to like the Henry Dargers of the world. You know what I mean? Like I don't think most people really understand the idea of like the folk art coming from a place that has no background, where it's like I look at your work, there's definitely a background here. There's just someone who like you obviously have seen and have been exposed to and practiced, you know, painting in a classical way.
Yeah, you know, and I was just talking to the filmmaker about this the other day, like, and he knew what I was talking about. I went to college in, like, the late 80s, and at that time it was all about the death of painting, you know. Conceptual art was the king, and nobody needed to paint anymore. It was over. And so nobody ever taught us even, like, how to paint anymore, and you could totally graduate from art school without even painting at all or knowing how.
That's not what I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't paint at all.
Right. And so everything that you see me doing now is totally self-taught from what, like, from just, it was hard work with oil, with the oil medium. Like making my own mediums and figuring this crap out. And, like I said to a guy in video once, and it sounded funny because I was talking about like Pratt, and then I said, well, I had really great teachers, but what I meant was like Rubens and Poussin, you know, and Gustave Moreau and like my heroes, you know. I literally like copy their paintings. I draw like when I got time to kill, if I'm at a bar, if I'm hanging out waiting, have a sketchbook, because I'm sure you knew this. You think you know drawing, right, looking at it, but if you try to draw it and copy it, you're like, holy smokes, like, you know, I didn't even see half of this painting, you know?
Yeah, because so much has to go into, like, you know, taking that flat, empty space and turning it into, like, a full 3D space. It takes a lot more than just, you know, copying the silhouettes of figures.
Yeah, and I've learned, and about the technical skills. So for me, like, I think my work is conceptual to begin with anyway because I have a concept, but I think I'm doing both. I'm painting and,
right,
you know, I'm doing a visual art and a conceptual art at the same time. So, to me, like a real oil painting, is almost like, do you use Photoshop? And you know how it has layers of things, mm-hmm, of images, right? Well, a real oil painting is the same way, man. It's like, it should be 30 or 40 layers, you know, on top of each other. And that your opaque stuff's underneath, your glazes are on top. Right. So when you light it up, the thing freaking glows like a computer monitor, you know? And that's just the coolest way, I think, to paint. And like, maybe I'm blind or missing something, but I don't really see people painting that way anymore.
No, I think the use of glazes is definitely, like, you know, I don't want to call, you know, be disparaging. I'm not trying to be disparaging, but, like, it's definitely being brought back by, I think, like, a selective, you know, small group of art nerds who are, like, you know, trying to touch on something they feel is missing in their work. Just like,
yeah, I do agree with you. Yeah, I think there is, like, I started calling myself a few years ago a post-contemporary artist, you know.
Yeah.
There is, like, the new school where, like, people just said, you know, F it. You know, I'm going to paint. Why? Well, why are you painting? Well, just because, like, I'm a human being, and it's, like, and it's pleasurable. You know, I think just aesthetically, making visual art with paint, like, in that way is important, you know. Now, I was thinking about this today, man. Like, Marcel Duchamp, right? Amazing, mm-hmm, artist, great artist. Stopped painting. He intellectually argued himself into a corner where he didn't make art anymore. I mean, do you know that he decided he was just going to play chess forever, right?
Right.
So he stopped making art. And I mean, to me, like, you have to be careful, I think, of over-intellectualizing what you're doing. Not, you know, in that way, you know, because you can argue yourself into not making art ever again, you know, and not painting and just, you know, doing conceptual work, where a friend said to me, you know, well, you could just write a sheet that describes your work and hand it out to people. a typed sheet, you know.
I guess, but that just sounds like, I don't know. I mean, I think I was kind of in the same boat you were in art school. I think I graduated probably a little bit later than you did, but most of my professors were like minimalists and conceptual artists. Like, you know, I basically learned, I was a sculpture major, so I learned in the shop and in the studio, like how to make things, and they really kind of helped me hone the concepts behind my pieces, but I learned little to no technique from my professors.
And like, what were you doing, like welding or ceramics, or what were you working on?
Welding wood and some ceramics, but now I don't even do that stuff because, like, my daughter's so young, I'm afraid of any kind of particulate in the house. So it's like,
yeah,
I've gone back to, like, I'm like reteaching myself like watercolor paint because it's like worst case scenario, if something like gets, you know, my wires get crossed, there's nothing dangerous that's going to like permanently harm her or me.
It's tough. Is she little, like younger than 5?
Yeah, she's almost 2.
Yeah, that's stressful time, no doubt.
Yeah, so it's just like that's what I've been doing lately. And to me, it's – I kind of see like now, you know, maybe in your work I see this too. Like instead of minimalist, you have like this maximalist kind of feel where it's like trying to go all out with it. Because the idea of – I like your friend's idea, the idea of like, oh, yeah, let's describe this whole thing and put it on a sheet of paper. But that's a great, really smart idea if you're in a conceptual contest or something. But like that's not engaging artwork. Like what's the twist?
Oh yeah, well
on
he
that?
Wasn't he wasn't saying that as a positive thing.
Oh yeah, totally.
You know, he was saying that, you know, that's what and to me that like to me, you know, the death of painting and it was a philosophy of art history that I bumped into. I bought the book just so I could like shake my head at it. The anti-aesthetic, you know, these people were anti-visual arts to me, anti-visual. And to me like that gets back to my, like, satanic thing. To me, you know, you have the Antichrist,
right,
the anti-aesthetic, the anti-visual. So, like, what I started doing a little tongue-in-cheek because my grandfather died and he was a he really was a doctor of philosophy. And he had a whole shelf, like, 5 feet long on demonic possession. And I read them all, and they absolutely freaked me out, you know, like true demonic possessions. And so it's, you know, that's how I first got into doing that, you know, type of thing. Like, I figured I would do, like, Satan cults and, like, Near Eastern gods and demons.
Right.
And then that led me into, like, ghosts. I started reading, like, Gothic horror novels. And so that's something that I was, again, thinking about today that I wanted to mention this filmmaker. I think I'm lucky in a way that I read so much. You know, when you read a book, you have to kind of get a picture in your mind of what's going on.
Yeah.
That I get ideas for paintings, you know, when I'm driving in the car, working in the yard, or I'll see like a visual image almost of a finished painting, you know? Where when I look at kids, even my kids today, who all their visual images are fed to them on like DSs or Game Boys or computers, like they don't have to make any. I wonder if their minds are blank, you know, when they walk around. They can't see pictures, you know.
Well, I definitely think like younger people, you know, younger than us, there's definitely more of a, you know, I even heard this from some of my professors that like, you know, everything that you ever wanted to do has already been done. It's basically now it's like editing and remix culture, where I feel like your work is coming from, maybe it's more literary, is like, maybe that's the thing I'm kind of pulling from it, but like I think for a lot of younger people now it's like, how am I going to, you know, you'll even see it like on the internet, you'll see like all these different artists like technique different takes on like old paintings and, you know, plays and conceptual, you know, fooling around with the old masters,
right,
and stuff.
And that's what I'm talking about too, which I think is a problem. Is that it's like a play, it's ironic, it's sarcastic, and like at some point you have to figure out what you really want to say. Like, and I don't mean necessarily to the public, you know.
Right.
And I've said this to people too, like there's a lot of artists who are competing with people who are working today or working 10 years ago or popular 20 years ago. I like to think that the people that I'm competing with lived like 500 years ago or 200 years ago, you know. And I just put it this way, like you just raise your sights higher, man, on like the eternal. not like these flashes in the pan and like these whims of fashion. The guys who I'm trying to compete against in my paintings, to me, they're like my friends and teachers, and it's literally like, you know, Delacroix and Rubens and Moreau, and, you know, that might sound egotistical, but if your heroes are way above you, it gives me, you know, plenty to reach for, you know.
Yeah, that's a smart, it's a smart way of looking at it. So you got interested more in the occult based on looking through those demonic possession books? Is that kind of where the inspiration for a lot of this occult stuff came from?
Yeah, my grandfather had books on, like, the whole gamut. He was kind of like a Catholic philosopher. He taught the philosophy of St. Thomas Aquinas. He was what they call a Thomist, and he had studied to be a priest, so he had a lot of priests who were friends who had literally, like, these pamphlets where they transcribed exorcisms that they had participated in and stuff like that. So these were transcripts of, like, true exorcisms, and I was just totally blown away. Like, you know, like, I came away absolutely believing, because these were aren't books like issued to the public. These were like in pamphlets that priests and would share with each other and stuff. You know, documents documenting like an exorcism that they did. And it was just, I was like, holy shit. You know, and I was able to figure out things about, say, like the devil. Like, to me, it was obvious that the devil knew the past but didn't know the future. The devil knew, like, all about these priests, because during exorcism, the devil absolutely will attack the priest to stay in the person they're possessing. Stuff like that, you know. But if the devil knew they were going to be thrown out of the person, it was just, if you read enough of them, I probably read 10 or 15 of these different types of books. And they were from, like, the 20s, 1920s, 30s, the 60s, you know. So.
It's funny you talk about your grandfather, because, like, yeah, it makes sense. Were you raised Catholic?
Yeah.
Yeah, because me being raised Catholic, too, I think, like, I'm not really religious anymore. I mean, my wife's even Jewish. I go to temple more than I go to church. And, like, but I still have that kind of that warm, fuzzy feeling for, like, those, you know, historical paintings of, like, of ancient Rome and stained glass and, like, the opulence of the church and the iconography I find oddly comforting. And I kind of get that feel from your work as well. Like, there's, like, a reverence not just for the, you know, telling these crazy stories, but a reverence for, like, the importance of the history.
Yeah, yeah. And I first got into it, an art that I really loved, was kind of like a little niche, was when they were still making art in, like, the pagan Roman style or image, and yet they were Christian. It's art from, like, the year 200 to, like, 300. And it looks kind of like classical Greek, maybe, or from the time of Caesar Augustus. But it's like Christian. It's like the Virgin Mary and stuff, but she's in, like, a toga, you know. And then I got, you know, you can get really into, then you look at that for a while. Then I got the illuminated manuscripts. There was a great show years ago about Armenian illuminated manuscripts, which just blew my mind. You know, the colors were really vivid and bright. And imagery of, you know, Jesus Christ going down to hell to bind Satan and stuff. And to me, it was like watching, you know, superheroes and stuff. And that's why I did some of my religious artwork since then. Like, it just made me rethink, like, what Christians think of Christ. I mean, he's almost like a zombie, you know. This is a person who died and was dead and came back from the dead, right? And people, like, we take that for granted nowadays, you know. People just go, oh, they're just Christians, they're nuts, or they're, you know, Jesus freak. But wait a minute, they're saying that here's a guy who died, you know, and he would have all these incredible wounds on him, right?
That's true, yeah.
I was just trying to get people to look at it again. Because when I was reading about go ahead.
No, because I think, like the Bacchanalia or the Feast of the Venus is, like, the characters are definitely kind of like, they're a little squat, and to me it read like, I know there's in art history class in college, I was always fascinated by this painted wall of this, like, Jewish synagogue. It was a Roman outpost, and all of the figures were almost like the same figures remixed over and over and over again for different, Old Testament or Torah characters. And part of that was because, like, in Judaism, there was no, like, visual drawing of the earth, like, kind of how, like, you hear that in Islam a lot. Like, it just wasn't part of the style.
I do think that's a mistake, though. Like, I would argue with that. I know that that is their tradition, but there are frescoes, like you say, from, like, around the time of Christ, from synagogues and stuff in the Holy Land.
But a lot of that stuff was really more influenced, and I think that what it gets back to, like, you're talking about your own influences, like, those were influenced because those people were exposed to, like, Romans and Christians and Greeks and, like, people from the steppes. Like, this is because cultures were intermingling. They were, they were still who they were, but because, like, they didn't have – they wanted to decorate their place of worship just like their neighbors were. They actually
literally
borrowed
a book. Except the guy pointed this out to me recently. I couldn't believe it. Protestants like to say, in the Ten Commandments, one of them says, I think, this first or so, I am the Lord your God, you should make no graven image, and that's where it comes from. But then it also says later in Exodus, God commands the Jews to make an ark and to put two angels on it, So on the one hand, in the Ten Commandments, it says not to make graven images that you will worship. But then later on in Exodus, like a few paragraphs later, it tells them to make an ark and to put figurative images on it. So.
And they wonder why Christian artwork is always so weird.
Exactly. So I would disagree with iconoclasts.
Yeah, oh yeah, totally.
I'm not an iconoclast, and a minor point.
Yeah, no, but I love that idea, the intermingling and, like, using, like a basic style and repurposing it for whatever purpose you got.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, right, of course, which was my original point anyway. Yeah, the cross-cultural stuff, to me, is some of the most interesting art, when things, like, aren't settled and whatnot. To me, that's why Gothic art looks so weird, because they're still using, perspective that makes the important people bigger, not important people smaller, and it's kind of flat and stuff.
So let me ask you, because this is the thing I thought, like, as I took the train home back to Jersey, as I'm reading through your like pamphlet, how much of this is like tongue-in-cheek and how much of this is like inspired by personal views, your artwork?
That's hard to say. I wish I gave you a few more of my other books, but I think I've been saying, I'm trying not to be so tongue in cheek, and I do have a point underneath everything, and I think definitely my work, I absolutely would agree, a lot of it's humorous and it's meant to be kind of funny, but I don't think it's meant to be funny. Ironic, it's meant to be. I think it's funny in a way of maybe mitigating the seriousness of what I'm dealing with.
Like gallows humor.
Yeah, in that way. But I don't think I'm trying to just be do artwork that's funny or silly. Well, one thing I realized, this is a philosophical point too, so when I realized that, I believe in demonic possession, oh my God, what does that mean? Well, that means that the devil is real.
Right.
Well, if you only believe in the devil, and you don't believe in God, well, then that means we're living in a madhouse, If the world is ruled by the devil. So I just thought I made all those paintings first, I made all these paintings, and then I built the novel around them just to tie them together, because it's important to me. I think I didn't want to talk about my work formally, the colors and this painting and the composition of this painting is this and this. I wanted to even make what I wrote about the paintings a kind of art,
Right.
At part of the presentation, I wanted the words to be as much of the presentation as the paintings, And that was kind of my way of telling people what I found out, you know, from the stuff that I was studying. So for me, it's real. I mean, I don't know. Some people have taken offense to it, I guess, but
there's always going to be somebody.
Yeah, but if somebody read that book, though, and thought that it was, like, pro-Satan, that's a big misunderstanding of my pen.
I think if someone read that book and thought it was pro-Satan, I think they have more issues than just what you wrote with. You know, like, that's a sign of other things.
Some church ladies think that and stuff. You know, there's a generation gap, I guess, sometimes, but it does say satanic deception. You know, people see the word Satan, but they don't see the next word is deception, you know.
Well, what I loved about it was the whole thing is written from the perspective of someone who's like, I guess obviously it's written from the perspective of someone who's trying to represent a friend's perspective. So I guess it's kind of once removed. But like the idea is it's like evidence of all this demonic possession, how the devil is real and this and that. And I think there is definitely some humor, but what I really liked about it, and this comes from this idea you're talking about, like, of the level of sincerity, is that where there's humor, it's not at the expense of the believer. It's just like, because what is going on in these texts or what it's learned in the actual book itself, it's just kind of messed up and kind of, you know, it's a way of dealing with it, the humor in it. I think that's what I really was drawn to most of all.
Cool. Cool. Yeah. I think that's a good reading of it too. Yeah.
Cause even like the paintings of, like, you know, the maidens and the Nazis, like, to me, it's, you know, yes, that's kind of like, it's very in your face. Anything with Nazis is usually in your face, even if they're Nazi zombies. But like, it's definitely, to me, it's more important of the idea of like evil versus good and beauty versus ugly, rather than like, let me paint some Nazis and see what happens in this crazy painting, to me.
Thank you, because, wow. So you actually get it, because that's exactly what it was to me. I read about a year or two ago, and it just blew my mind because it said so much that I agreed with Edmund Burke's On the Origin of the of Beauty and the Sublime.
Right.
Where he goes through it all. So, like, I've been obsessed with that, like, really into the sublime and 19th century romantic painting and, like, what is beauty and what is sublime. So, to me, I finally reached this point where I wanted to put the most beautiful thing with the most horrible thing, you know, and that's what I came up with, you know. And I know it might look just totally tongue-in-cheek to somebody, but I really was trying to juxtapose those ideas, you know. And I know, but I'm trying to push the envelope a little bit, because even, you know, I know to consider like a woman a beautiful thing, well, all that sex that I'm objectifying a woman or something, but I mean, I sometimes have to stop caring what people think.
You can't get too much into it, but I don't think it's necessarily bad if someone goes, oh, I love these Nazi paintings, I really love the idea of zombie Nazis and hot chicks with guns. Like, if they get it on that level, I don't necessarily think that that's like the worst thing ever. Maybe it's a little bit problematic from like the standpoint of like maybe it's used the artist that they're not getting everything, but the fact that
I totally agree with you again, because that's part of what I'm talking about having just levels of interest and being able to look at something for like a couple of years, you know. Yeah, there's to me, a complex artwork should have all that. It has like the gratuitous thing right off the bat. Okay, there's violence and there's naked women, sure, and people can get that real quick, but there's like you were saying, but there's a whole lot more, I think, as well.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in these. I mean, like, even just like as landscapes, and I'm going to pick on the maidens and the, I'm going to call them the maidens, the ladies and the Nazis, like, just the,
so
as
up,
landscapes are interesting
website,
too.
So I'm probably looking. Thank you, man. Thank you. Cause, and like I said, my freaking teachers, I learned so much from Poussin. It makes me mad that people call him a landscape painter now. I've seen every single one of his paintings has somebody been killed or eaten by a snake or being struck by lightning or something. I was like, man, this guy's making landscapes just so he can, like, go wild, you know. But it taught me so much, like, just great shit you can do for the viewer. Like, put a lake in there with the reflection of the people, you know. Put in some crazy flowers to make it cool, you know. put in some trees, put in that symbolize something, you know. I learned like a tree stump, a chopped down tree means like the loss of virginity in Renaissance art, or that like a rape was going to happen.
Oh, interesting.
Right? Little things like that can just, you know, you can just add all these like layers of meaning and interpretation.
And I think, like, to me, because I know you talk about growing up on Long Island. Like, I'm from New Jersey. I'm still living here, basically. But I'm from, like, this northern part of New Jersey. And we have this magazine called Weird New Jersey.
Yeah,
and I think part of the thing that drew me a lot to the work is maybe it's just, you know, growing up here, there's always that juxtaposition of, like, you know, weirdness and grossness and beauty at the same time. You know, because New Jersey is like the whole tri-state area is like a nice place, has a ton of history, but then it's also like, you know, a lot of crazy crap has happened here as well. Like you go through the stories of, like, I mean, a good example is they have, like, you know, every state has like a quote unquote midgetville. They're like these. I know out in Totowa, this town in Totowa, there's like this little village of like these houses. The houses can't be. The roofs themselves, like the peak of the roofs, can't be more than 7 feet tall. Like the rumor was they were originally designed for like people who worked, like little people who worked for P.T. Barnum. Or
really?
People. Yeah. Like, I don't know. They're just probably just like low income housing. It was probably the cheapest thing, the fastest thing to make in the 50s or something. But there's all kinds of rumors, and you have like all these kind of like this weird kind of folklore that kind of, you know, arises around a lot of this weirdness, you know, just, and I, growing up around that, you know, it kind of electrified my childhood, the idea of like weirdness and evil and life and death is around us all the time, and it's not necessarily a scary thing, it's just a fact of life. And I think in your work I kind of get that feel too. It's like, look, there are, you know, centaurs raping women in these paintings, but it's not like, you know, it's just another day, and it's just another, you know, explanation of the history, and it's, you know, it's just part of the whole fabric of mankind or Western culture or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree with that about weirdness, too. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a huge fan of a guy, actually, I think he lived in New York City for a long time, H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah.
I read all his books. They're just awesome. And the weird, I've always been drawn to the weird. I'm a huge horror movie fan, you know. Do you know this director, Mario Bava?
No, I don't know. I've never heard of that person.
Oh, man, you should. If you do Netflix or anything, a buddy of mine turned me on to him maybe like 2 or 3 years ago, and I just put his name in Netflix, and I just kind of put everything that he made in my queue. He made a movie called Black Sabbath, which I think where the band got their name from. But just really, to me, 60s horror movies, like now, and this is something I was just thinking about like last couple of days. You get these horror movies now, and it's like a slasher movie. It's like a Psycho, right?
Right.
Comes with a big knife and he kills everybody. It's literally materialist. It's like what you see is what you get. You know, there's no. But in the 60s, it's like these Mario Bava movies. It's because there's a ghost and there's like a demon and there's a devil. Like, I'm starting to reach this conclusion. Like, you can't make a movie like The Exorcist, which to me is like the best movie ever made, if you don't believe in God and the devil. So like the world that the atheists are now trying to create for us is going to be a world of boredom and suicide, and not worth living in. And that's kind of like what I've been thinking about a lot lately. Like, all right, so this is okay. So Christians are stupid, okay, and the world. What we're being offered to replace it is suicide, if you ask me.
That's cultural. Interesting.
Yeah, it's the end. It's like nihilism.
I mean, like, I mean, personally, like, someone who, you know, I'm not really a religious person, but I definitely see that a little bit in your work. But I don't.
Yeah, but I mean, you don't even have to be religious. Like, I mean, the ancient Greeks who weren't even Christian, and Jesus say wasn't even born yet. They believed in, you know, right and wrong and good and evil and, you know, stuff like that, which
right.
Seems to me like postmodern man is willing to totally throw out the whole idea of good and evil, you know. And I mean, you don't even need to be a Christian to believe in that.
But I love that place. It has in your work that idea of like the existence of good and evil, right and wrong, and I think it's some of the most engaging parts of a lot of these paintings.
Yeah, thanks. Like, it's like the issue. It's almost like the sublime, you know, like beauty and terror, and I wish. Well, I just hope I bump into. Sometimes I feel like what do you call it? I'm like John the Baptist in the wilderness, crying out, you know, trying to meet like you know a kindred artist who, you know, might feel the same way. So it's cool. I'm really psyched that you reached out, you know, and the things you're saying. You're really looking at the work thoughtfully.
Yeah, no, it definitely speaks to me. And I definitely want to try and show it off to a bunch of different people and then send people over to your website to see all of it. I mean, I'm not going to put that many images in because I don't want my podcast to be a one-stop shop to look at your artwork. I don't necessarily think that's such a great idea, but I'm going to definitely tease some people with some images so they can go over and check your site out and see exactly what you're doing because I think a lot of it is definitely – I think mind-blowing is not too strong of a word.
No, thank you, man. Thank you very much.
So that is our interview with artist Michael X. Rose. That was so much fun to record with Michael, and hopefully we're going to try and get him involved with more stuff here on newmediator.org. If he has any other shows, he said he would definitely reach out for us, and we're definitely going to talk in the future. Definitely check out his website, michaelxrose.com. Of course, there is a link in the show notes at newmediator.org, and we'll have a couple images up there as well. And if you want to have any comments, questions, or concerns, you have a question for Michael you want me to forward to him, you can just email me, davelamorte@gmail.com, or leave a comment over at newmediator.org. There's a bunch of ways to contact me through there. So don't be shy. Don't hesitate. I'm more than happy to help field your questions, your complaints, because they're probably all true. So that's pretty much it for me. Thanks a lot, and please stay subscribed.